The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles to you from the Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today we will end our tour of the main theme of the May issue of Our State magazine. The theme was entitled A State of Beauty and Grace. And our first article is entitled A Swan Song. Reflecting on the most graceful creature he knows, an outdoorsman is buoyed by the memory of tundra swans descending on our coastal plain until the great white birds wing through our skies once again. By the time a tundra swan makes it to northeastern North Carolina in the fall, it has flown some 3,000 miles in a great diagonal slash from the Arctic Barrens down the breadth of Canada. The birds then wing across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. A few stop along the Great Lakes marshes, but most fly nonstop all the way to Chesapeake Bay, where they gather by the hundreds, and then the thousands, and then the tens of thousands. Then they lift off from those fields and brackish shallows. Their ultimate destination is in mind, North Carolina, where some three-quarters of the entire eastern continent's tundra swans put down roots until the lengthening hours of early spring beckon them back northward. And they take a bit of North Carolina wherever they roam. The Rocky Mountains have their grizzlies. Alaska has its moose. Florida, its silver king. The tarpon, iconic species all, the very sight of which strikes awe in those lucky enough or hardworking enough to find themselves in encounter with such creatures. In North Carolina, we have the magnificent tundra swan, a sort of modern-day griffin, though there's nothing mythical about Cygnus columbianus. It's as real as a cold January wind sweeping across Pamlico Sound, as present as a full moon in a blue winter sky. If ever a creature deserved the appellation charismatic megafauna, the tundra swan is it. I've seen these birds winging singly over duck blinds in the Currituck Sound salt marsh. I've seen them in undulating skeins, opals against the sky, above the wild waters of eastern North Carolina, Pungo and Manamesquite and Phelps Lakes, the Alligator River, Currituck Sound. I've watched them while huddled in muddy farm ditches as far inland as Nash County. Once, while writing about nesting gear falcons along the soaring cliffs of Alaska's Seward Peninsula, I camped along a remote river where breeding swans nested in hummocks of reed and sedge, their pearlescent forms dotting the tundra. I wondered if I'd ever seen those very same birds in the air over my distant North Carolina home. But no matter where the encounter takes place, I've never seen them when their presence, their calls, their silhouettes, their shimmering flocks, fail to root me in place and give wing to my own flights of imagination. Tundra swans are a gift from wild places we might only dream of, a feathered testament to the connectivity that still binds our world. Wild is drawn to wild. This is a refrain for those creatures who need the largest expanses of the natural world to thrive, and so it is for tundra swans. Here the birds flock to some of the least trammeled environs left in the old North State. In the coastal plain, 9 national wildlife refuges sprawl across more than 350,000 acres, interspersed with dense private forests and agricultural fields that lie fallow in winter. The landscape is a smorgasbord of marsh and shallow brackish waters, and harvested fields of grain, attracting one of the world's greatest collections of long-distance migrants. Tundra swans come, flock after flock. At their peak, some 65,000 to 75,000 tundra swans spend the winter in northeastern North Carolina. There are other swans known in the region. The larger trumpeter swans are almost exclusively found in the Midwest and West, but a handful wander to our state. Mute swans are non-native to North Carolina and non-migratory, but they're occasionally seen. Larger than tundra swans, They sport an orange bill, an easy way to sort them out from the tundra swan's nearly all black bill. And what of the whistling swan, a bird that bewitched Meriwether Lewis near the narrows of the Columbia River? Their calls, he wrote in 1806, cannot be justly imitated by the sound of letters, nor do I know any sounds with which a comparison would be pertinent. It begins with a kind of whistling sound and terminates in a round, full note. This is the self-same bird that settles in North Carolina each autumn. The tundra swan was once known as the whistling swan, and occasional references call it that still. On their breeding grounds, the tundra swans must defend their nests against all manner of predators, wolves and bears, golden eagles and glaucous gulls, jaguars and ravens. Compared to such a fraught summer, a North Carolina winter is easy street for the swans. Predators are few, and the bird's only job is to eat, replenishing the body fat lost during migration and fueling the return to their breeding grounds. The swans descend like white curtains into soybean and grain fields to feed on the leftovers from the harvest. In shoreline marshes, they eat sedges and grasses. In shallow ponds and impoundments, they stomp their large webbed feet to stir up snails, clams, and insects. And in the air, they adorn a blue sky in skeins and chevrons that herald the season. When there are tundra swans in the Tar Heel State, the breath of Boreas will soon be felt on every bare cheek. Of all the places to see tundra swans in North Carolina, few are as evocative and entomic as the Matamiskeet National Wildlife Refuge. The eponymous, oval-shaped lake, 14 miles long and 5 miles wide, is set like a jewel near the end of the 3,200-square-mile Albemarle-Pamlico Peninsula. The largest natural freshwater lake in the state, Matamiskeet is ringed with marsh and cypress trees and is shallow enough to walk across. Swans show up on the lake and its associated impoundments by the ones and twos and twenties and hundreds. Thousands roost and feed there after their southward migration. It's a meeting of the primordial and the primeval, ancient drawn to ancient, as the massive birds set their wings to glide into their wintering grounds. At Matamiskeet, the swans feed in the shallows around cypress trees, etched in silhouette against the low sun. It's a scene that draws photographers and birders from around the world. Footpaths and vehicle trails allow visitors to plumb deep into the marshes and close to the shore, where the swans dabble and preen. But it is in flight when they are seen, they are at their most impressive. Their wings beat to a rhythm written in the Miocene. Their gondoliering legs, as described by the poet Marianne Moore, trail behind them. If you are downwind of a winging swan, you might hear it 5 minutes before you see it, its voice carried in the air like a Gregorian chant from a distant valley. If you're upwind of one, the breeze might carry its cries away, and the sight of a swan suddenly in view can stop the heart, or at least give it a jolt. In ancient days, it was believed that the swan sang but once in a lifetime to herald its death. That's the origin of the phrase swan song. But Socrates and Plato clearly had never been to Pungo Lake or Pea Island National Wildlife Refuge or the water lily community on Currituck Sound, where the tundras sing often and long and loudly and unforgettably. No matter the species, the swan's snow-white form, its grace in the air, and its proclivity toward mating for life have served as fodder for poets and artists for centuries. Virgil was called the swan of Mantua, Shakespeare the swan of Avon. In one ancient Greek myth, Pantheon, son of Helios, drives his father's chariot too close to earth, drying up rivers and burning mountains. To prevent further destruction, Zeus hits him with a lightning bolt, and he falls into the river Eridanus. His distraught friend Sicinus, grieves by the riverside and is turned into a swan. For displaying such love and sacrifice, the gods place the image of Cygnus in the sky. This is the constellation Cygnus, the beloved swan of the northern sky, whose outstretched wings and neck in turn form the Northern Cross. In another Greek myth, Zeus becomes smitten with Leda, the beautiful daughter of the king of Pleuronius. He takes the form of a swan and seduces the young princess. Leonardo da Vinci sketched his version of the scene, and Michelangelo and Rubens painted it. In more modern times, the poet William Butler Yeats wrote of swans, lauding their soaring heights. The wings half spread for flight, the breast thrust out in pride, whether to play or to ride, those winds that clamor of approaching night. But I'm not sure that any poet, nor painter, nor muse of the ancients can add much to the enchantment of watching a flock of tundra swans on the wing. The pure science of the sight beggars the imagination. That a bird fully 6 feet wide and 4 feet long can clock thousands of miles in flights, catty-corner across our continent, is testament to the stunning intricacies of animal migration, and to the tundra swan's own fortitude in getting from A to NC and back to the Arctic again. Overhead, the first birds in the V-shaped formation bear the brunt of wind resistance. Over time, others must move forward to relieve them of the burden. But there's more going on in a V of swans than birds taking turn to be leader. During flight, a swan with its beating wings creates a pocket of disturbed air, a turbulence that spirals down and then upward behind and to the left of each wing. The bird behind and to the side lines up its own wingtip to catch this rising vortex, timing its wing beats to save energy and propel itself more easily. The swan behind it does the same, as does the swan behind it. This formation flight creates the distinctive V-shaped echelon of migrants, each aiding its comrades in flight. Each swan shares the burden of its migratory flight with all the others in flock. No one is without a helpmate. Let it be the bird in front, behind, above, or below. No one is on this journey alone. Unus pro omnibus, omnes pro uno. One for all for one. It's a lovely way to look at a flock of swans winging overhead, as if the sight of a tundra swan in flight needed any additional adornment at all. Our next article is entitled Magic Wings. In Durham, colorful discoveries abound year-round at the Museum of Life and Science. Sometimes visitors searching for butterflies like paper kites find them among the plants inside the Magic Wings butterfly house. And sometimes, as Thompson Rice can attest, butterflies like blue clippers find them. And the two pictures on this lead page, one is someone holding a magnifying glass and finding a butterfly. And it says it's a paper kite. And it's basically an off-white and black butterfly. And then the facing picture shows a young man. His name is Thompson Rice. And he's looking upward, and a butterfly has landed on his forehead. I'm sure he was quite thrilled with that experience. My boys and I have come to Durham's Museum of Life and Science to find treasure. From a science lover's perspective, this place boasts a trove of riches. Bears, leafcutter ants, dinosaurs, and right behind the farmyard animals is the bounty of jewels we came to see, the Magic Wings Butterfly House. Settling into its 26th year, Magic Wings is a 35-foot-tall, glass-ceiling, glass-walled conservatory filled with more than 200 species of tropical plants. Inside, the air is warm and moist and smells of loamy earth. A royal court of crested wood partridges scuttles officiously through the undergrowth. A sound of water filters through the vines, and tall green plants fill the spaces between floor and ceiling. But these sounds and scents and plants are only window dressing. The jewels we seek are the butterflies, up to 50 species and 1,000 insects at any given time, flittering and floating throughout the house. Each year, close to 500,000 people come to see them, just like my 9-year-old Pete and 7-year-old Thompson, and I have. Blue morphos open their dull brown outer wings to reveal a dazzling iridescent blue that flickers like an electric shock with every wing beat. Paper kites, the kaleidoscopic black and cream cousin to monarchs, seem to prance across the foliage with their long legs. Clippers, which look like their wings are painted with dusty eyeshadow, perform aerial acrobatics right next to our heads. Hold out your finger, Magic Wings director Yuli Hartman says to my sons on a tour of the conservatory. You can let them walk on you. They do, and astonishment turns to glee. Each butterfly begins its life as an egg. Delicious to predators and unable to move, eggs are a dangerous way to start any life. Butterfly mothers do what they can, usually finding plants that their babies will eat once they hatch, and hiding their eggs as best they can under those leaves. Inside each egg, they give nourishment to form caterpillars and their cells called imaginal discs. Those last cells are the cells of dreams, of imagination. Most of the butterflies at the Magic Wings house came from faraway eggs. Hartman works with families and villages in 5 countries around the world. These families are the butterfly keepers. They find eggs, harvest host plants, and nurture the growing caterpillars until the insects shed their final grubby skins to reveal the chrysalises beneath. The practice keeps safe the land as well as the butterflies that need the land to thrive. These farmers are our outreach conservationists, Hartman says. They don't take the forest down and don't spread pesticides in their yards. Instead, they work to keep their world a better place. The butterflies help the people thrive, too. Tending young butterflies, feeding caterpillars, and sharing them with the world helps sustain entire villages of families. Under care of these international farmers, caterpillars grow exponentially, from the size of a pinhead to the size of a pin, from the size of a period to the size of a run-on sentence. The caterpillars chew almost blindly through anything green. They look nothing like their parents. They are wingless, worm-like, often hairy, with mouths made for cutting leaves, not sipping nectar. Still, they carry their mother's gifts from the egg, whose imaginal discs, the seeds of imagination. When they shed the final skins of their youth to reveal chrysalises, or in the case of moths, spin a cocoon, their caretakers collect them and mail them to Magic Wings. When he receives them, Hartman glues these chrysalises to twine, hanging them like trophies on a wall. He keeps them safe behind glass, giving them the warmth and moisture they need. Some look like golden baubles, other like living green leaves sprinkled with silver dewdrops. Some look like lichen-crusted twigs. Some look like rolled-up dead leaves. We watch these chrysalises, moving our eyes from jewel to jewel, hopeful that one will break and a butterfly will flip out with rumpled wings. "She's coming out!" Tom exclaims as one begins to merge. A black blob tumbles from a leafy green chrysalis and spindly legs tap until they gain purchase on her former skin. She hangs upside down, revealing her long body and wings like a rumpled cape. We can see her wings pulse as she pumps them with fluid from her body. They expand a tiny amount with each pulse, and we begin to see the shape, bits of yellow and blue, spots and straight lines. She's a clipper. She'll become a strong flyer soon, capable of twirls and flips 30 feet in the air. "How do they fit in there?" asks Pete, who's holding an atlas moth as big as a salad plate while looking at the brown silken cocoon from which it emerged, half the size of a couple of walnuts. We look beyond at the thousands of wings floating between the green and the spindly legs picking around orange slices at feeders. Those clippers and paper kites, those morphos and glass wings, with wings clear as window panes, delicately rimmed with vibrant colors. It's hard to reconcile the caterpillar and the chrysalis, harder still the chrysalis and the winged marvel that is a butterfly. One thing people love about butterflies is that these insects seem miraculous, too fragile to survive in this complicated world, too amazing in their transformation, too beautiful to be members of the writhing mass of insect society. It's magic. It's a miracle. The real secret to butterflies can be found in what they carried with them when they were in their eggs, those imaginal discs. When a caterpillar sheds her grubby skin to reveal her chrysalis, inside she digests herself fully. She turns her recognizable form into a mass of pulp. Gone are the legs and bristles. Gone are the chomping jaws and the capsule-like head. What remains is the pulp and her imaginal discs. These are the signposts. The discs know where to go without knowing. Each disc moves to its predestined place and uses the pulp to form the parts of an adult butterfly. Wings, eyes, antenna. Slender bodies, mouths like rolled party horns. The imaginal discs that the insect carries as caterpillars, hidden, make the real dream of flight. Magic Wings, under Hartman's care, fills our senses with these flight dreams. Smell the damp air. Hold out fingers to receive six filamentous legs tapping confidently on our hands. Watch the Atlas moth weave its hulking body across our paths. The zebra stripes, the candy apple reds, the owl eyes painted along the undersides of wings. Watching my boys poke and wander between the vines, I wonder what parts of them they will carry, like the caterpillars with their imaginal discs, and what parts they will leave behind. And what about the rest of us? Which imaginal pieces are formed us? What did we shed with the junk of history? The caterpillars have no idea. We don't either. Nothing in life is guaranteed for caterpillars, nor for us. But if we all hang in there long enough, a metamorphosis could come. Magic Wings holds these fever dreams of nature like a big domed cradle. It unfolds the implausibility of our ordinary world, coasting on paper-thin wings. The Museum of Life and Science is located at 433 West Murray Avenue, Durham, 27704. You can find out more information at lifeandscience.org. We'll wrap up this episode with a couple of short articles. This one is entitled, Meet Me at the Movies. Generation of Roanoke Islanders have watched films and shared boxes of popcorn at this historic cinema that's welcomed audiences since 1918. One of Michael Bassnight's earliest memories is of a field trip to the Pioneer Theater. He and his Manteo Elementary School classmates waddle down Budley Street, little excited ducklings to see a movie on a school day. When he was a bit older, Bassnight's parents or grandparents would drop him off at the theater, and in the summer he'd ride his bike there with friends. As a teen, he took dates to the theater, just as his parents, aunts and uncles and cousins had done before him. The Pioneer Theater has been at the center of Manteo's social scene since the Creef family opened it in 1918. You might not remember the movie, but you remember the smell where you sat, the popcorn, Bassnight says. In 2023, he bought the 105-year-old theater with family partners Jamie and David Hatchell, along with Derek and Sharon Hatchell, all multi-generational Outer Banks natives. It's that experience that's so important to keep alive. The new owners removed the Tudor facade that had been added to the building in the 1970s, returning the theater to its original beige brick exterior. They also installed a snazzy lighted marquee and vertical pioneer sign, similar to the one that crowned the theater in 1934, when the business moved away from Sir Walter Raleigh Street to its current location. They updated the ticket booth and interior while preserving the history and beauty of the Pioneer, and repaired but didn't dare replace the famous Secreters and Company popcorn machine. Inspired by his childhood trips, Bassnight now invites today's Manteo Elementary School students to visit the theater to watch a classic movies, like a 1973 animated Charlotte's Web, munch on popcorn, and make memories that will surely live in their minds for decades. And the Pioneer Theater's on Budley Street in Manteo, and you can find more information at thepioneertheater.com. There's a couple of pictures here as well. There's the new facade, which looks like an old school theater. It's very nice, and with lighted marquee, and Princess and the Frog is playing. There's also a picture of the Michael Bassnight and Jamie Hatchell, a brother and sister, siblings, and who bought the theater. And then there's the picture of the Creator's popcorn machine with the old school popcorn boxes, narrow and said popcorn on them. And then the lobby looks like perhaps they restored the floor, which was a inlaid tile flooring with stars and some black and white markings and very nice dark wood and such. Very, very beautiful restoration, it looks like. This article in the House and Home section is called "The Pipes Are Calling." In Wake County, a native of Scotland teaches others how to craft beautiful bagpipes and the art of playing them. Roddy McClellan began playing bagpipes as a kid in Glasgow, Scotland. Eventually, his interest faded, but after immigrating to the United States in 1980 and seeing pipers at a Scottish event, he was inspired to pick up the instrument again. "The sound is haunting," the Wake County musician says. "It's visceral. It appeals to the emotional part of your brain." He went to a local shop to buy a set of bagpipes, but having studied metalsmithing and woodworking at the Glasgow School of Art, he realized that he could make an instrument of higher quality. He later left his silversmithing job to craft bagpipes full-time. When he began thinking about retiring from his world-renowned custom bagpipe business, friends encouraged him to move to Zebulon to teach others to make the instruments because of the local bagpiping community. Raleigh is home to one of the largest pipe bands on the East Coast. Now in his shop in downtown Zebulon, McClellan teaches a new generation of craftspeople to carve the drones or pipes and engrave the metal mounts with intricate designs. He also teaches a new generation of musicians to play the instrument. He knows that not everyone loves to hear the bagpipes, but for him, there's nothing like their stirring tones. And if you're interested in learning more about McClellan Bagpipes, they're located on North Arundel Avenue in Zebulon, and you can look them up on the web at McClellanBagpipes.com. That's McClellan spelled with McClellan Bagpipes.com. Well, that indicates we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long until next time.